from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
This week on Register Radio, the No Nonsense Report. Dan Berg discusses the release of the Vatican's long-awaited report on women religious with Register correspondent Ann Carey. Also, Jeanette DeMello talks with author Austin Ivory about his new book, The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. Welcome to Register Radio, a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Elena Rodriguez, sitting in this week for Tom Price. The editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, Jeanette DeMello, will lead our second interview. But first, the executive director of the National Catholic Register, Dan Burke, will start us off. Thank you both, Jeanette and Dan, for being on this week's show. Our first guest is one of our correspondents at the National Catholic Register, Ann Carey, a member of the Catholic Press Association and a veteran journalist for more than 30 years. She has written investigative news stories about Catholic women religious, and she is working on a new updated edition to her book, Sisters in Crisis. Ann Carey is here to inform us about the release of the Vatican's long-awaited report on women religious. Ann Carey, it is good to have you here with us again on Register Radio.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Dan?
Well, Ann, you've been a favorite guest of mine, mainly because it seems the Lord has given you this glorious task of helping to bring healing to the women religious of the United States. And so once again, we're talking about this great task and that the Vatican has undertaken it from a number of different angles. Before we get started with the recent report, I think we should bring clarity to our listeners regarding the distinction between what the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith is doing and the Congregation for Religious Life is doing. Could you give us a brief overview?
Sure. I think a lot of people are sort of confused because two separate activities were launched by the Vatican at about the same time. The first, an apostolic visitation of women religious, was really decided on in December of 2008, and it was approved by Pope Benedict at that time, and then it was announced in January of 2009. And that was a visitation to all of the orders of women religious in this country, the apostolic orders, not the cloistered, to determine the quality of life of the sisters and to look at some issues that had been reported to the Vatican, concerns that had been raised, some of them doctrinal, some of them liturgical, some of them having to do with authority within the orders, some of them financial. And Cardinal Roldan himself, who was the prefect at the time, said he was quite concerned about the lack of vocations, too. So that was announced in January of 2009 and conducted by the Congregation, well, I call it the Congregation for Religious, but its whole name is the Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life and Societies of Apostolic Life. So you can see why I shorten it. And anyway, then this probably was decided in 2008 sometime, but we didn't learn about it until April of 2009. The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith said that it was conducting a doctrinal assessment of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. And that is the umbrella group for about 80% of the sisters' orders that tend to be less traditional. There had been a lot of talks at their various assemblies, et cetera, and some of their publications that had some very questionable doctrinal matters in them. Plus, the sisters in the LCWR earlier, around about 2000, 2001, 2002, had written some letters to the Vatican in support of Sister Jeanine Gramick and Father Nugent, who at that time had been silenced for their work with New Ways Ministries. So it was decided that, and the LCWR was told back early in the 2001 that it had these problems and it needed to clean them up. And when they weren't cleaned up, then it was decided to go forth with this doctrinal assessment. That was done by Bishop Blair of Toledo at that time. He's now Archbishop of Hartford. And he sent his report to the Vatican, and in 2012, the Vatican appointed Archbishop Peter Sarton of Seattle to oversee a reform of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. That is ongoing.
Yeah,
Whereas the doctrinal assessment ended as of yesterday when the final report was given at the Vatican.
Right. And so the common ground here is is the Leadership Conference of Women Religious is in 2009, the average age was about 74, if I remember right. Now it's got to be closer to 80, not very few, very low on vocations. And the Council of Major Superiors of Women Religious at that time was about 10 years younger, which I think is getting even younger because they are attracting vocations.
Yes, in fact, and let's just be clear, the Council of Major Superiors of Women Religious is the other conference of superiors of women religious in this country. And they are the I call them classic form of religious life, where the sisters live in community, pray in common, wear a habit, do a community apostolate, and work in the name of the church. Whereas the Leadership Conference, many of those orders are more diverse, not all of them, but most of them, I would say.
Right.
So there are about 10,000 sisters that belong to orders that are represented at the CMSWR. Their average age now is 53, according to Mother Agnes Mary Donovan, who's head of the Council of Major Superiors. She spoke at the press conference yesterday. So that really, I think, is where the future of religious life is. Now, those numbers are small. I don't think we'll ever have 180,000 sisters as we did in 1965. That was kind of an anomaly because some of those were the baby boom generation.
Yeah.
But definitely the Leadership Conference is going to lose vast numbers of sisters within the next few years simply because of the high age. Yeah.
This is Dan Burke with Register Radio, and we're talking with Ann Carey, who is our expert on women religious, particularly in the United States, and the author of Sisters in Crisis Revisited. I can't recommend that book more enough for those who want to understand what's going on with women religious in the United States. So, Anne, so that's a good backdrop. Now tell us a bit about the report. We're going to focus not on the doctrinal assessment of the LCWR by the Council, by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, but more on the
apostolic visitation.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, that had been ongoing for some time, and the person appointed to head that up was Mother Mary Claire Malaya.
Oh, it's the Apostles of the Sacred Heart of Jesus.
Sure. She completed her report. There were teams of visitors that visited about half the women religious in the country, and data was gathered from all of them, even the ones who weren't visited. So she wrote a general report on the conditions that she found in general in the country, and then individual reports on all the various orders that were visited, and handed those into the Vatican in January of 2012. So we've been waiting for the Vatican report all this time, and finally it came yesterday.
Yeah, and the report seemed to me to be a bit vague, but I understand that there were specific reports delivered to the communities that we assume were much more detailed. But why don't you just give us an overview? You wrote a piece for us at the Register called The Vatican Thanks Sisters and Calls Them to Unity and Self-Evaluation. So let's talk about the specific requests that the Vatican gave to these.
Sure. Yeah, I describe the report kind of like an onion, in not that it was bitter or made me cry, but that you have to kind of peel back the layers to see what exactly was in there. Because as I put in my article for the Register, at first glance it looked like a love letter to the American sisters because it was so full of praise.
Appropriately so.
Look at what women religious have done for the church in this country particularly. I mean, they have built most of the institutions and structures of this church in the country. So appropriately so, absolutely. But very gently embedded in the document, after you peel back some of these layers, were several concerns, and that word was used, concerns. And some of them were, well, for one, is that it mentioned that a lot of the new candidates coming into religious life do not have adequate formation in theology or spirituality. So it emphasized that that needs to be strengthened in the orders. Another thing was it said that a lot of the orders have documents where they define the liturgical practices very clearly, but it said those practices were not always put into action, and so that that should be reevaluated. There was a mention about doctrinal problems, and it called on orders to carefully review to be sure that their teachings and practices are in harmony with Catholic teaching about God, creation, the incarnation, and redemption. I thought that was very key. There was one about keeping the differences between vowed religious and laity. I think that was put in because in so many orders, lay associates are getting very active now in the administration of the order. And according to canon law, a layperson cannot be a superior to a vowed person. So that was interesting that it was put in there. A lot of things were left unsaid, though, I thought. For instance, one of the comments it made was that most communities said that the young people tend to want to wear a habit and they want to live in community, and that this is a challenge to the orders that don't live that way. And I thought that would have been a perfect opportunity to have said, well, if you have the elements of religious life, the essential elements like life in community, prayer in common, shared apostolate in the name of the church, you wear a religious garb, you have obedience to superiors and the Pope, you attract young vocations. So I thought that that was kind of a throwaway line that should have been embellished more. Also, there was not much said about the finances, only that the sister should observe evangelical poverty. I think that was a bit of a disappointment because I know some sisters are worried that their orders are selling their assets at below market value, and that those assets perhaps could go to better use for the church and also for the sisters, too, given their high age group.
Well, Anne, we're unfortunately running out of time. I'd like to just point people again to the good work you've done for the Register of the Vatican, Thanks Sisters, and Calls Them to Unity and Self-Evaluation. You also have a blog post from signaling that this was coming from, I think, December 4th or 5th, and Edward Pinton also has a piece exploring this as well. So we're covering it very well at the Register because we have a deep love and appreciation for those who've given their lives to the church. And thank you so much, Anne, for your work in helping to serve them to heal and continue on with the important work that they do.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure because they were my teachers for about 12 years. So it's very little for me to do for them.
And thank you both, Dan Burke and Anne Carey. When we return, myths and truths about a pope. You probably know who I'm talking about, and we'll set the record straight. Jeanette DeMello will talk with author Austin Ivory about his new book, The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. This is Elena Rodriguez, and we'll be back with more of Register Radio right after this break. Keep it here on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Only one newspaper can deliver in-depth news coverage to millions of Catholics around the globe, offer a Catholic perspective to world events, and bring you inspiring stories and articles of faith and courage. Only one newspaper has insightful, award-winning journalism that continues Mother Angelica's dream of providing Catholic news true to the teachings of the Church. The National Catholic Register, the source for commentary and opinion on the most important political, economic, and social issues facing Catholics today. The world needs the truth. Now you can be part of it by donating to the National Catholic Register. Help us continue our mission. You can make a difference with a donation, large or small, to close the funding gap we're faced with. Go to ncregister.com/donate or mail your donation to the National Catholic Register at P.O. Box 100699, Irondale, Alabama 35210. With your help, our voice remains strong. Without it...
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. Along with Dan Burke and Jeanette DeMello, I'm Elena Rodriguez, sitting in this week for Tom Price. The Register's editor-in-chief, Jeanette DeMello, will conduct our next interview. Our guest is Austin Ivory, a London-based Catholic journalist and author of the newly released biography, The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. A former spokesman for Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor in England, Austin is also the author of How to Defend the Faith Without Raising Your Voice, and the coordinator for Catholic Voices in the United Kingdom, which is an initiative that trains Catholics to present and defend church teaching in the public square. Austin is here to set the record straight about the making of a radical pope, Pope Francis. Jeanette?
Austin, it's great to have you on Register Radio today.
It's great to be with you.
You know, Austin, so your book, The Great Reformer, it's a book about Pope Francis, it's a biography, and there have been so many biographies or books about Francis that have been written in the last 18 or so months. Why your book? What was the inspiration in writing a book about Pope Francis?
There have been a lot of books about him and about his papacy, but there haven't been very many biographies. Most of them have been by Argentine journalists, and most of them have focused on the later part of his life as Cardinal Archbishop, which is what most journalists are familiar with. I felt there was a need for a biography that really digs back into his past, into his life as a Jesuit, his whole intellectual formation, and, of course, the controversies of the 1970s. And I was... felt particularly qualified for this because 20-odd years ago, I did a PhD at Oxford University precisely on the church and politics in Argentina. So I'm an example that a walking example that sometimes PhDs can be useful. having grappled with all those issues, I felt I could act as a kind of bridge, if you like, between the complexities of Argentina and the Anglo-Saxon world.
Of course, of course. And as you say, the complexities of Argentina, especially during the Jesuits themselves, is a huge part of your book. It's a very complex part of your book. And I think it's probably what is the contribution that you give, as you say, to all of this understanding of Pope Francis that is sometimes lacking. Can you explain, I guess, one corrective that your book gives to maybe some of the myths about Pope Francis?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that I did when I first arrived there last October, and I went to see the Jesuits in Cordoba in Argentina, and I said, you know, where are all these articles that he wrote as a Jesuit? I knew he'd written lots of spirituality articles, and I'd assumed that they'd all been edited, you know, since he became Pope and republished and so on, but not a bit of it. They were gathering dust on their shelves, and they pulled them down and said, you know, here they are. And I pulled through really what was, 20 years really worth of writing on his part. And I think what comes through so amazingly from those writings is a man of tremendous spiritual depth and discernment. He was a master retreat giver, a wonderful discerner of spirits in that kind of primitive Ignatian Jesuit tradition, and that he saw himself as a leader, as a provincial of the Jesuits, in taking the Jesuits, as it were, away from the temptation of ideology and focusing them on the raw gospel and on service of the poor and on being missionaries. And he did this at a time when the province was very divided, when Argentina was very divided politically, when there was on the one hand, you had the guerrilla movements, which had a kind of Catholic nationalist discourse and so attracted many Catholics. And then, of course, you had the ferocious dictatorship of the 1970s, which also justified itself in Christian terms. So in this very divided context, his reform of the Jesuits was to focus them, if you like, on their core mission. And I see a tremendous continuity between that and what he's doing now as Pope and what he later did as Cardinal Archbishop of Buenos Aires. I mean, you talk about the myths. I mean, you remember that after he was elected Pope, there was a lot of accusations in relation to two Jesuits and allegedly complicity with the dictatorship. I go through all that in forensic, but I hope not tedious detail, and I exonerate him, as has everybody else, really, most people anyway, who have looked into this. What I'm interested in much more is what happened between him and the Jesuits, where the breakdown happened in the 1980s, which ended up with him being internally exiled, and where the origins of the so-called black legend came from, because, you know, when he was elected, there was a kind of groan went up from Jesuit houses around the world, many of whom had come to believe a lot of things that were frankly untrue about him, and the book traces the origin of those myths.
Very good. Yes, and it does provide clarity, I think, in terms of understanding better his relationship with the Jesuits, but also, and you mentioned this, just how that Jesuit spirituality influences papal message today. And I wanted to talk about that for a minute. You talk about ideology versus true hope and true reform versus false reform, and those things are extremely interesting in the book, and definitely worth the read for understanding better what he means. But let's talk about how he applies discernment and the spiritual exercises to his papacy even today. Can you give us some examples of that?
I think the most obvious example is the Bishop's Synod, which the first part of which was last October and will end in October next year, looking at the questions of the family. And he sees it as he's described it, as a privileged space in which the Holy Spirit can act. So what he sees is about, when he tells the Synod Fathers to speak fearlessly and to listen humbly, and when he wants to protect that space from, for example, you're allowed to say whatever you like, but it won't be reported as you saying it. This is all about his understanding of the conditions that are necessary for the Holy Spirit to act within the Christian body. Now, this is something for which I show in the book. It means his life has prepared him, his early work intellectually and practically prepared him. He has a very deep understanding of how you can create those conditions such that existed in the first centuries of the church when the great councils developed the church. And conversely, what leads that process astray? What can result in splitting into ideologies and into parties and into divisions? So when he spoke at the end of the synod to the synod fathers, and he gave that extraordinary speech, which was just like a retreat giver, saying basically, look, live in the tension, you know, and don't leap, don't grasp at either trying to be ideologically rigid or trying to conform church doctrine to the world. Those are false, you know, false escapes. You've got to sit in the tension, trust in the Holy Spirit. And he was saying to them, in effect, you know, allow the Holy Spirit to work. So this is very, very typical of him. We've just had the extraordinary news about Cuba. We've had him bringing together leaders from the Middle East, building bridges through which he believes the Holy Spirit can act, relationships often of trust and of friendship, and which allow the Holy Spirit. So it's all about creating those new opportunities for the Holy Spirit to act, and then holding things in tension and giving them time in order for them to work. That's where I see this Jesuit training and his experience as a leader in the church being so clear.
This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to Austin Ivory, the author of The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. Now, one of the things I love about your book is the way that you incorporate stories with the history that you provide. Each chapter begins with a story, a current story, and then you use that as a jumping off point to go into the history. It's a great way of doing it. One of the stories, though, it's not necessarily the leading off story, but it's a story you tell, is about Bergoglio when he was a young man and got very sick with the lung infection. And the nurse who increased his dosage, which Bergoglio believes saved his life. And there's this beautiful analogy between the nurse versus the doctor, and the nurse who works in the frontier and the doctor who works in the laboratory. You really draw an analogy about that. What is that analogy, and how do we make sense of it today in how the Pope has been preaching?
So this is one of those very typical Francis oppositions or dichotomies, which he uses quite a lot, the laboratory versus the frontier. In the laboratory, people basically believe in ideas, believe in artificial human constructs, and they fall in love with them. And they try and operate according to those. Whereas if you live on the frontier, you're in constant interaction with reality, with real human lives. So this is one of his contrasts that he draws between a church which is self-referential, which is basically focused in on itself, often enchanted with the beauty and the purity of its own truths and its own doctrines. And of course they are true and they are beautiful, and that's why we fall in love with them. But sometimes we can not allow ourselves to go out and encounter people as they are. On the eve of the conclave, in those meetings that the cardinals had, he used a very powerful image which struck many of the cardinals. Quoting the famous passage in the book of Revelation, he said, you know, I think it's not so much that Jesus is on the door outside knocking to be let in. It's more that we've got Jesus tied up in the sacristy and we don't let him out. You know? And that was an image, in fact, he'd used just earlier in Buenos Aires. I think this is a key, really, to understanding so much of what he's trying to get the church to do. The really big reform is to turn the church, a church which has been perhaps sometimes too much built for clarity, now to make it more geared to mission. And that's how I understand that.
That's great. Now we have just 2 minutes left, and that was my story. That's the story that attracted me. Is there a particular story in this that really spoke to you and really captured you?
I was constantly struck throughout the book. The more I went into him, the more I researched his life, was how fearless he is. Mm. He really can live in tension, and the way he can reach out and build bridges really is extraordinary. He has an extraordinary capacity for that. And I think many of the most touching stories in the book are precisely that, with evangelicals, Jews, with across the political boundaries. But I think the thing that perhaps continued to touch me as I drew towards the end of the book were the numbers of so-called white rose stories. He has a strong devotion to Saint Therese of Lisieux, and he has often said that when he prays to Therese, he usually gets given a white rose. So I became fascinated by this, and I actually asked the people who used to work with for instances of this, and I've got some really quite remarkable examples of white roses being given to him in the most extraordinary moments, very dramatic moments. And then even more amazingly, after he becomes Pope, in the conclave, he goes into the Santa Marta, which is where the cardinals were staying. He goes into his bedroom and he finds a white rose on his bed.
Oh, wow.
And really quite extraordinary things like that. And then, I mean, on the vigil of the prayer for the Middle East, for example, he was strolling in the Vatican Garden and the gardener gave him a white rose. That was just after he
was
praying.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
So I think those are the stories, I think, which in a strange way touch me the most, because they just show that here is a man who is just deeply, deeply connected through prayer.
Well, Austin, thank you so much for this great book. It truly is a great work. As I said, I love the way it is written, the stories and the history. They go very well together. Our listeners can find more online at ncregister.com. Joan Desmond recently interviewed Austin, and in the title of that story is Unraveling the Francis Enigma. So, Austin, thanks very much, and good luck on promoting your book.
Thanks so much, Jeanette. It's been lovely to be with you.
And thank you both, Jeanette DeMello and Austin Ivory. You can read more about Pope Francis on an interview by Register Senior Editor Joan Frawley Desmond, who interviewed Austin. It's titled Unraveling the Francis Enigma. You can go to ncregister.com and do a keyword search for Francis Enigma, and you'll get it. Don't forget, you can listen to our show again by going to ncregister.com. Look for the microphone to listen, and you can even download the show. On behalf of Dan Burke, Jeanette DeMello, and Carrie Austin Ivory, and all of us here at The Register and at EWTN Radio, thank you for joining us. This is Elena Rodriguez, and we'll be here again next week for more of Register Radio.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Imagine if you could help inspire millions of Catholics around the globe by providing a life-changing perspective on the events of the world. Imagine if you could bring faithful Catholic journalism to clergy, seminarians, and religious. Imagine if you could be a part of continuing Mother Angelica's dream of providing faithful Catholic news true to the teachings of the Church. You can do all this and more by donating to the National Catholic Register. The Register needs your help to continue our mission and close the funding gap we now face. You can make the difference with a donation, large or small. Go to ncregister.com/donate or mail your donation to the National Catholic Register at P.O. Box 100-699, Irondale, Alabama 35210.